KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Increasing overnight, the low in the upper 30s. Clouds and rain tomorrow, the high in the mid 40s.
Doesn't mean that we are doing poorly on every account. In terms of equitable access to care, we have actually much better results than most other countries.
Windows 8 is more than the next version of Windows. It's a new way of thinking about your PC.
The first 10 days are much harder than after the first 10 days because it takes a while for your body to understand that it has to feed off of itself.
Matthew McConaughey on losing weight for his new film, Dallas Buyers Club. He's had a bit of a comeback this year. We're going to talk about comebacks with Robert Horton. Windows 8, setting the world on fire? Well, we'll find out from Todd Bishop. But we start with what's happening in Canada, where we heard a little bit about Canada emergency wait time from a doctor in the Canadian Institute for Health Information on the Canadian healthcare system. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun. He joins us every Wednesday on weekday. Hi, Vaughn.
Good morning, Steve.
Vaughn, we just had an hour where we were playing with toys and we're just packing them up. And I know that your children are also not playing with the same kinds of toys as they used to play when they were much younger. But, you know, if you're looking to give some toys to Toys for Tots or whatever the Canadian equivalent is, there are some very cool toys out there right now.
Yeah, but they're mostly with my daughter, electronic things that I don't understand how to work that cost more than my first car. So, you know.
That's what I'm saying.
And that tend to be made by that company from Seattle that everybody's heard about. And I don't mean Boeing.
All right. Well, there's some other toys out there for some of those kids that are still in us. All right, Savon, what about this ER waits? Canadians face the longest ER waits in the developed world?
Yeah, so this is courtesy of the Canadian Institute for Health Information, CIHI, a worthwhile institution that was set up a while ago to basically keep data independently on the Canadian healthcare system and provide us with some points of comparison between us, how we're doing across the country, how we're doing with other places in the world, and this stuff from on wait times and ERs, it's another reminder that our healthcare system, which looks terrific on paper and which Canadians support and love very much, doesn't always produce the best results. And the ER wait numbers are pretty bad. They found that half of Canadian patients will be cooling their heels for more than 4 hours if they visit the emergency room, whereas less than 5% of emergency room patients in three comparable countries, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the Netherlands, will face similar delays. So a lot of Canadians are going to the ER either because they don't have a doctor or because what their condition or situation is deemed to be not a full-blown emergency. These are not people that are coming in from automobile accidents. And they're waiting a long time, and that isn't what happens elsewhere in the developed world.
You know, these go on top of these times, long wait times for family doctors and specialists, which haven't improved for almost 8 years, wait times of 3 months or more for some specialists are commonplace. What are people saying is the reason for this poor performance?
I think it's two things. One is a lot of Canadians either don't have a family doctor or leave whatever their problem is to inconvenience like after work or weekend, and they just go to the ER and wait till it gets dealt with. And what you tend to find when you go into an ER in Canada as a result of that is a real variety of people. You get emergency cases, and obviously those are being dealt with. They're being triaged and dealt with right away. And then you get a whole bunch of people that if there were more walk-in clinics, which we're starting to build, if people had a family doctor, if people weren't working and coming when they're not working, might not be there at all. And so the ER tends to partly be a warehouse. And you get people that go in there, and because there's no room in the hospital right now, they may be kept in there for a number of hours. So it's it's kind of the fail-safe point of the entire healthcare system, and as a result, you're getting an awful lot of people in an ER that if the system's resources were organized differently, it wouldn't be there at all.
So if you have this report coming out, what's, as they say, the deliverable? How are they going to improve the system, and is it affordable to improve it?
Well, I mean, the system is being rebuilt now across the country in a variety of ways. And remember, our national government pays a lot of the bills on health care, but our provinces run the system, and as a result, the system varies dramatically from province to province. But what you're seeing is a system that they are trying to rebuild to disperse resources differently than the way they have been in the past, to, I mentioned, sort of walk-in clinics. Doctors increasingly like fixed hours, so what you're seeing is the government is setting up walk-in clinics, group of doctors work there. People, instead of having a family doctor or going to the ER, go to the clinic, and an awful lot of stuff is dealt with there. But it's a cumbersome system, and it's bureaucratic, and it's taking a long time to bring about these changes. They're trying to get more home care established. It's much cheaper, obviously, if instead of seniors who have a range of medical problems or people with chronic illnesses who have a range of problems, instead of them being dealt with in the very expensive setting of a hospital, we're trying to establish a network of care homes, of home care with people going into the home, because that'll be cheaper, it's a better quality of life for people. But again, in our system, all the resources tend to be used on keeping the system the way it is. And for a lot of these changes, you need more funding on top of what is already a very expensive system to bring about the changes and ease us to a different world of healthcare. And that's a big challenge for our governments. You know, they're spending a staggering amount of money. I think here in British Columbia, the healthcare system for the entire province is consuming about $50 million a day, $17 billion a year. It's almost half of our government budget. They're making the transition, but that's still an awful lot of money for a system that produces mixed results.
Wow, that is serious money. And, you know, as you know, people south of their border are looking north and thinking, what's our future?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at systems around the world, you can probably find things in many of the healthcare systems elsewhere that are admirable, that produce results that, you know, are very good. A lot of the European systems produce better results than the Canadian system does. And yet, I think if you, anytime you talk healthcare in Canada, what you immediately get from Canadians is, well, we don't want the American system. Well, no one's suggesting that we're going to take the American system, but we might get better results if we took a variation on the Swedish system or the French system or the German system. Even the Australians and the New Zealanders have some variations that produce better results. But you know how it is, Steve, when you're, it's like when Americans look at the Canadian system, they pick the things out of it that they like, right? They tend not to focus on the things that Americans probably wouldn't stand for, like the waiting list, for example.
Right. Right. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun, joins us every Wednesday on a weekday. So, all right, Vaughn, activists across the West Coast are looking skeptically at proposals for new coal ports, Washington and Oregon in particular. People are saying we want to study this, if nothing else. That's the minimum. We hear the governors and the senators, representatives saying that they want to see a full study and a vetting of these proposals to put coal terminals on the West Coast. Now that concern is spreading up to Canada?
Yeah, it is. I mean, British Columbia, first of all, already exports a lot of coal. If you come into Vancouver, take the ferry at Tawasin, just north of Point Roberts, just north of that ferry terminal is a big coal port at Roberts Bank. We ship a lot of coal out of British Columbia there already, and there are proposals to expand coal shipments through the other two sets of docks around the city of Vancouver, the ones up the Fraser River in Surrey and at Neptune Terminals in North Vancouver. 14 million metric tons of additional coal to be shipped out of the city of Vancouver on top of what we're already shipping. And there is an environmental backlash. There are people saying we shouldn't be doing it. Coal is contributing to global warming. Coal dust is a pollution problem. And we shouldn't be expanding that. On the contrary, we should be contracting production. Of course, the same, as I say, I'm sure the controversy is not surprising to you down there, because you've got the same discussions going on in Washington and Oregon.
Well, the article you sent quotes Eric DePlace, who's a senior researcher at Sightline right here in Seattle,
yeah,
talking about that historically BC has shipped metallurgical coal, but
yes,
this would be more thermal coal, more coal,
yes,
that'll be burned in mines and burned in plants in China coming from U.S. mines.
Yeah, we've done major deals here in British Columbia going back a long, long time to sell coal to Asian markets. We had a deal with Japan for a long time, shipping metallurgical coal to their steel industry. We have major customers in Asia, and mostly, yes, in the past, what we mostly produce is metallurgical coal, and what we're mostly selling is to a steel industry. But thermal coal is an increasing possibility. In fact, there's discussion here that if the port development is blocked in the United States, of course, there are rail lines that lead from the United States into Canada. We may end up, actually, American coal may end up being shipped out through the Port of Vancouver.
Now, I see that American as well as Canadian environmental activists are involved, put a letter out from Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein,
yep,
saying these proposals are not in the best interest of Canadians nor anyone else. They hasten climate change. What response from that so far?
Well, the response is this is a major part of our economy. It's a major reason for the existence of the Port of Vancouver. It's a major producer of jobs. Even if it's American coal we're shipping, that underpins our economy. And obviously, if we've got customers for Canadian coal, that's even more jobs and economic development. And the other thing, of course, is, and you'd know this, is the oddity of who gets the bill for coal exports, coal that is burned into the atmosphere. If you burn the coal here, that goes to our carbon production tally. This is if you're in a carbon trading system or a cap and trade system. But the country that burns the coal is the one that gets credited with the greenhouse gas production. So, I mean, we export, we wouldn't stand for coal-fired generation in British Columbia. We're proud of the fact that we're 95% green. It's hydro and a little bit of natural gas for power generation here, and we're starting to build a few wind farms. I mean, we wouldn't allow coal-fired generation in and around Vancouver. But, you know, it's a somewhat different situation to say we'd sell the stuff to somebody else and they might build a coal-fired generating station.
It is one world. We did a story on Puget Sound Energy, and they have a pretty strong renewable portfolio. But the Sierra Club was saying, you own this coal plant in Montana, yeah, where you're one of the worst polluters in the West Coast.
Yeah.
Puget Sound Energy saying, well, we're trying to come up with a balance here, but in a big planet, balance is hard to attain.
I agree with you, and especially hard if you're moving to a cap and trade system for measuring and capping greenhouse gases. That doesn't square at all with where the stuff is. There's no connection in that system at all over where the stuff is burned and where the stuff is produced, right? I mean, and we do, you know, British Columbia buys electricity at times from Alberta. Well, we're buying it from coal-fired generating stations in Alberta, right?
Yeah. All right, Vaughn, last two stories. A border dispute? Canada has,
yes,
border disputes?
We still have a border dispute, and it's over two islands. So there's a bunch of disputes between Canada and the United States over where the boundaries go through waterways. So there's a disagreement at the mouth of the Strait of Juan de Fuca and a Dixon entrance with Alaska. But there are actually two islands, two pieces of land that are still in dispute. There's a nice piece in the New York Times about it last week by a researcher, and he points out that Machia Seal Island and North Rock, two small islands, one is described as a 20-acre treeless lump. Doesn't that sound appealing?
Let's go there for holidays.
near Maine and New Brunswick. They have been a subject of dispute between the two countries since the Treaty of Paris. You remember that? It was in all the papers in 1783. And he suggests wisely that we settle this thing because Right now, the waters around them, of course, are a subject of dispute between lobster fishermen. But, you know, what if somebody finds oil and gas there? Then we're really going to care about who owns the two islands.
Oh, man.
We maintain a lighthouse on one of them. The United States government regards the territories being in dispute. And so far, the two countries haven't been able to agree on a basis for even sending them to international arbitration.
Wait, so you guys have a lighthouse on one, and we sort of circle it saying, oh, you shouldn't have it there?
That's right, Yeah.
That's
good. You go ahead and have your lighthouse there, but don't kid yourself thinking you own the island.
I see.
I suspect if it were not a 20-acre treeless rock, we would have probably settled this thing some time ago.
Well, as you say, they'll find something.
Maybe we should put an international friendship center on it. I think that would be, you know, wouldn't that be a great thing to do?
Or a coal exporting terminal.
Okay.
All right, what about Denmark?
Well, we got a dispute with Denmark, too. That's up north. We've sort of sorted out most of the waterway. So this involves Canada's Northwest Territories, Ellesmere Island, and then Greenland, which, you know, is Denmark. So there's an island up there that I suspect when they settled on the boundary up through there, it was probably covered in ice and nobody even knew it was there. It's called Hans Island, and we haven't settled the ownership of the land. We have made progress on the water around it, so there's still hope. But there's another island up there that we're arguing about as well. So I've got an idea. Why don't you give us Matthias Seal Island, and we'll give you Hans, and you can fight it out with the Danes. Sort of like hockey trading.
Yeah, that'd be all right, except I'm looking at a picture of Hans Island, and it is also a treeless lump.
There's a lot of them out there, you know. These places are not, you're not going to put a summer place on most of them.
I see it also as a native name, which tells me that there were probably some other people that think that it's their island.
That's a very good point.
Tartupaluk.
The Inuit people probably regard both the Danes and the Canadians as interlopers.
Yeah, no kidding. They have some questions about that as well. Inuit living in northern Greenland had likely crossed this area for centuries, according to my Wikipedia.
Yeah.
All right, Vaughn. Well, we will settle our border disputes in a gentlemanly fashion by sharing toys at some point.
Okay.
We'll talk
Good to
you
talk
again.
Talk to you next week.
Take care. Vaughn Palmer, political correspondent, Vancouver Sun, joins us every Wednesday on a weekday.
Coming up, we'll take a look at some of the big Hollywood comeback stories of 2012. Film critic Robert Horton joins us next.
Support for KUOW comes from Evergreen City Ballet, presenting The Nutcracker December 1st through the 16th in three different venues. Clara and the Prince travel to the land of sweets, featuring mice that escape into the audience with falling snow and the Sugar Plum Fairy. Tickets at evergreencityballet.org.
We have a mix of clouds and sunshine in Seattle, 47 degrees right now in the U District. Forecast says it's going to be cloudy and breezy today with scattered showers, the high right around 47. Cloudy tonight, chance of evening rain increasing overnight, the low in the upper 30s.
Seattle Arts and Lectures and KUOW present writer, filmmaker, and musician Miranda July at Benaroya Hall December 5th. July will tell her story of correspondence with a man in prison using video, photographs, and audience participation. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
I was in the dollar store yesterday, walking through as I am wont to do, and they had the snow caps there and the junior mints, Robert Horton.
Yeah.
And once again, I thought, a dollar. But then I wouldn't be able to go out to the lobby and enjoy them with the dancing snow-capped creatures.
Steve, I wish I could help you with that dilemma, but
It's just the way it works, huh?
Yeah.
Robert
That's
Horton.
The eternal question.
Robert Horton is a film critic at the Herald in Everett, where you may soon be able to fly internationally or nationally right from Payne Field. If you're, you know, jetting off, we'll bring movie stars in, perhaps, to Payne Field.
They have a direct flight to the Cannes Film Festival.
That will be their first commercial flight.
They're calling it Payne to Cannes. Can I copyright that?
Yeah, you should right now. You should probably get the Everett mayor, who likes the idea of commercial flights in Payne Field, to start. They have a film festival in Everett?
They do. And they've also hosted a leg of the Seattle International Film Festival for the last couple of years.
Yeah. All right. So there you are. Payne Field. It's going to be happening. If some people have their way. Robert Horton is a film critic, longtime contributor to this fine radio station and this fine radio program. You were on this program before it was even called Weekday. It had no name at all. He is also a blogger at The Crop Duster, which is his blog. And he hosts The Magic Lantern, a monthly series of discussions on cinema at the Fry Art Museum. We're talking about comebacks, and you wanted to mention this play you went to, because we were thinking about comebacks.
Well, and, you know, last
week... I'm making a tie-in.
Well, and last week we were talking about biographies in film and sort of exploring that idea of Lincoln and Hitchcock and other such things. And I attended a play last weekend that's going to be playing for a couple more weekends called Rosebud, The Lives of Orson Welles.
The Lives.
Lives, yeah. So different, suggesting the many different phases of Welles's kind of incredible life. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I was we had a little Q&A afterwards, sort of talked about Welles with the director. And it is an interesting look at this amazing American life and his genius, which was acclaimed when he was still in the cradle, yeah. And which he believed, which he had it, but he also sure believed it.
So there's two mistakes. One, having yourself proclaimed a genius when you're too young, and secondly, believing it.
Yeah, although, you know, then you come up with Citizen Kane and
all right. The radio well, there's that.
Broadcast of War of the Worlds and so on. But the show was written by a British writer named Mark Jenkins a few years ago, and it has been revived. And I guess it's the first time this has been presented on the West Coast anywhere by a couple of people who are in Port Townsend, Chimicum area, and are taking it around and have it at West of Lennon, which is the theater in Fremont.
What did you learn about Orson Welles?
I guess I already knew about Orson Welles, but the play is an interesting kind of seamless cruise through his life, taking it from the days when he was a radio actor and at the age of 22 he was remaking the rules of the New York stage as this wunderkind, which he was, and then you go through his rise and fall and his rise and
talk about comebacks, huh?
It's really fascinating. And you get to the actor who plays him is named Eric Van Bezukum. Sorry.
It's all right.
I'm apologizing to the Eric. Bezukums. And he has this uncanny resemblance to Orson Welles. So it's like he's kind of a big guy with a similar face. So it's got that resonance. It makes it interesting to watch. But just thinking about Welles, he's one of the most fascinating people in American arts in many ways of the 20th century.
Right up to his Johnny Carson appearances where he was serving wine.
Doing magic tricks, doing commercials to try to make money to make his next film project without interference. Yeah, quite a life. Ups and downs and everything in between.
What is he? Did he? I mean, what do you think? We were talking about comebacks. Did he have a series of comebacks, or did he have one slow decline with blips?
Well,
that's a comeback.
I don't know. If you look at it from sort of a public profile kind of thing, how can anything after Citizen Kane, making the greatest movie ever made when you were 25, be anything other than a decline? And certainly a lot of people have characterized it that way and thought about it that way. If the thing is, when you look at his later films that he was making in the 50s and 60s, Touch of Evil or Chimes at Midnight, or into the 70s with F for Fake, which is an amazing documentary, the genius was still intact. You know, he may have changed his shape, literally. He may have kind of sold out his image in order to make money on commercials and all that sort of stuff, but he was still every inch the movie-making genius. He just couldn't work very much in doing what he really wanted to do.
Because he couldn't raise the money? People didn't want to give him money? What was the story with that?
Well, there's a lot of different problems, but one of them is that. One of them is that he got the reputation as a man of great extravagance, perhaps couldn't be trusted. And he also made a lot of people angry, people who were in positions of power. William Randolph Hearst, notably, among them, the guy upon whom he based Citizen Kane mostly. He ruffled a lot of feathers, and maybe there was something in him that courted a bit of self-destruction as well.
What did you get from F for Fake? I've never seen that film, but I thought Touch of Evil was great.
It is brilliant, yeah. F for Fake is a very playful, ingenious documentary on the kind of the nature of art and imposters and fakery. And it's just fascinating. It's like a magic act. It's like watching a magic act in a way, but you're watching a movie, and he's mixing together all kinds of different documentary pieces and his own autobiography as well as other people's that get drawn into it. It's a absolutely delightful, insightful movie.
Genius.
Yeah. See F for Fake. You should see it. It's out on a really good DVD now.
All right. I will. Does he fit into your notion of comebacks that we were also talking about today?
I don't know. At some point, there must have been something like that, but in probably many, many different comebacks. But I was just thinking, because it's December, that we're kind of looking back.
On this year.
Yeah, I was thinking about some of the people who had a 2012 that, whether it was a comeback or whether it was just a kind of course correction or a very shrewd move or rediscovery in some way, there are people who just had really good years in that sense.
All right, well, go down the list. Who had a course correction? Did you make that list that way? Were you thinking of it that way when you?
No, they're just a jumble. But I would suggest Sally Field maybe had a kind of a nice something or other by taking the role of Mary Todd Lincoln in the film Lincoln that is out now, Steven Spielberg's film, a role that is could easily have been relegated to the sidelines. You know, it's Lincoln's semi-crazy wife that we hear about and that always seems like a little bit of a drag when you're trying to read a biography of Lincoln or something like that. And much to the film's credit, she is a player in the movie, and she has two or three scenes that are really kind of amazing and that are fully thought out and show a very complex person. In fact, this is one of the first times where I've ever read or seen a depiction of Mary Todd Lincoln where you kind of understand why this great, brilliant man would have married her. Because otherwise
that's nice.
She's still often portrayed as just a little bit batty, and she spent a lot of money, apparently, and had some instability. But really, she comes across as a totally fascinating person. And I have to say that Sally Field is really, really good. She nails it. And part of the reason that I'm proposing her as a comeback or course correction is that she apparently took it upon herself to lobby for the role. She had been cast in it a few years ago by Spielberg when he was going to make the movie with Liam Neeson. For a variety of reasons, I think they kept rewriting the script. That went away, and Neeson got too old, and so on. And Daniel Day-Lewis was cast. Sally Field is, I don't know, a decade and a
66
half.
66 is what I just looked older. Her up. She was born in 1946.
She's a bit older than Daniel Day-Lewis and by a decade or more, and quite a bit older than Mary Lincoln was at the time that's being depicted. And apparently there was some sense of, well, we've recast Lincoln. We're gonna have to recast that. And she really, she auditioned with Spielberg, and she set out to knock them flat, and apparently she did. And she is really terrific in that role. So I count that as quite a if not, it's not a comeback because we know who Sally Field is, but she's at an age where actresses in Hollywood tend to get relegated to things, and it's quite a turn.
Yeah, she would have been in her 40s, Mary Todd Lincoln, in the time
I
of
think
this.
In her, something like that, her late 40s.
Well, she was born in 1818, so yeah, she would have been in her 40s, and that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Of course, Sally Field has always looked younger.
I was going to say,
years, so that's not really a problem.
Yeah, I was going to say Sally Field has been, like, she played Aunt May in Spider-Man, right? And Aunt May was supposed to be ancient, and yet Sally Field is not ancient.
She's pretty good.
Good.
Yeah.
So, and then, all right, so if that was a course correction or a strengthening, What about Matthew McConaughey, who I thought I wrote off a long time ago?
Yes. Well, I think many people did. And such is the nature of his kind of reversal for this year, because he worked incredibly hard, apparently, over the last couple of years. And a bunch of movies came out at the same time that caused critics especially to sort of say, wow, he's kind of going out there a little bit and trying some different things, and mostly has gotten awfully good at that prospect of maybe being more of a character actor than being the guy who walks into a Kate Hudson movie as the designated beefcake.
Designated beefcake.
Kind of can handle the light comedy or whatever. He's got in Richard Linklater's film Bernie, he is playing a real-life sheriff on a very wacky murder case that is at the heart of that very wacky and totally entertaining movie. And he's good at that. He's a Texan, so he kind of leans into that. That's a story of Texas, and he leans into that. He got a lot of some pretty good acclaim for Magic Mike, Steven Soderbergh's account of male strippers, in which McConaughey is kind of the most Mephistophelian, I guess, of the he runs the joint at this place where the guys are stripping, kind of a Chippendales kind of thing.
Dallas.
And
his name's Dallas, his character.
Oh, okay.
Texas.
And it takes place in Tampa, the hotbed of male stripping, apparently, and female stripping. But he's quite outrageous in that. I think you were playing a clip earlier that was talking about his next movie, which is going to be a film in which he's apparently lost a lot of weight. And so he's really torturing himself along with taking edgier sorts of roles. He was in a movie called The Paperboy.
Yeah, what was that?
He's pretty good. It is a ridiculous film with Nicole Kidman and Zac Efron. It's kind of like a Tennessee Williams on acid sort of experience. And it's just completely over the top. And it's based on a Pete Dexter novel, but is just an absurd.
Oh, it's based on Pete Dexter's novel?
Yeah.
But they take it in a different direction.
Oh, I don't know about that because I haven't read the novel, but it is overbaked by about 100 degrees. Yeah, it's a crazy, crazy film. And yet McConaughey is doing a character actor thing in it that you can kind of stand back and say, okay, I see what he's trying to carve out here.
All right. Good. Good.
Well, yeah.
I like to see people get a second shot at it and do well.
Exactly.
I do. Because I am,
you're looking for the second shot.
I'm looking for the second shot, and I'm a humanitarian.
Well, 2013 might be your...
Might be my year for the comeback. All right, now what about this filmmaker that you were talking about, Davies?
Terrence Davies. I put him on my list of people who have kind of come back because it had been 12 years since he had made a fiction feature. This is the English director of Distant Voices, Still Lives, which I think should be now considered a classic. A brilliant film, filmmaker who often returns to Liverpool, his hometown, for kind of reassessing. And one of the saddest movie makers alive, maybe that's why he takes so long between movies, I don't know. But he made a film called The Deep Blue Sea that came out this year, which Rachel Weisz just won an award from the New York Film Critics for.
Really?
And she is very, very good in it. And it's based on a Terrence Rattigan novel and is just or a play and is just absolutely as somber and thoughtful as Terrence Davies' previous films are, and is very much a kind of fugue piece.
Are you saying he makes sad films, or he personally is a sad man?
Well, he makes sad movies. I've read interviews with him, and he does sound pretty sad, but clearly he's a complex fellow, and he gets it all on screen in a really articulate way. And most of his stuff has been kind of autobiographical, but this is obviously based on a pre-existing play that he responded to strongly. Has to set, is it after the war or just at the end of the war in England? Anyway, it's about a woman who is married but is tempted outside her marriage and the consequences of that.
Well, that's going to make anybody sad.
It is a sad, sad film, but really, really quite beautifully done, I think.
It's interesting that he has such a role as a career as an actor as well, Terrence Davies. All right, one last comeback,
okay.
A positive one, and that was Searching for Sugar Man Rodriguez, the story about this Detroit rock and roller who
cut a couple albums in the early 70s.
Had a huge impact in South Africa's effort to end apartheid.
Yeah.
It was the anthem for a lot of people.
Had no impact anywhere else. His albums flopped in the United States. Nobody ever heard of him. But for some strange reason, they sold in South Africa in that bubble of apartheid, and it was were found inspirational. And won't give away the whole thing of the movie, but this figure Rodriguez, who's the singer-songwriter, has been rediscovered and largely because of this film, Searching for Sugar Man, which is just one of those documentaries that comes along and you just. What an incredible idea for a documentary. What an unbelievable story at every turn, and quite stirring.
Well, and Rodriguez turns out to be this amazing person who worked hard and labor and day labor, but was always working for the community and cared about his community.
Quite a spiritually minded fellow, or at least, yeah, salt of the earth. It's fascinating on every single level, but it certainly counts as a rediscovery. For this guy, this musician.
All right, then. Those are some good comebacks to
there
think about.
There you go.
We'll think about more.
Okay.
And this whole year. Robert Horton reviews films for the Herald and Everett. He talks about the big picture and the little picture for us on KOW's Weekday. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Slap at the bass.
That sounded like Borat.
Yeah.
Slap at the bass. Big time.
That's better.
The actor Paul Rudd has a secret weapon. Insecurity.
I would say there's been a very awkward thread through a lot
true.
Of the stuff that I've
that's
done
true.
Recently. And that's because that's the way I feel many times throughout my day.
Paul Rudd, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
That comes your way Sunday night at 7 o'clock. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 10:41. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle area Whole Foods Markets, presenting Bag Hunger, a charitable event taking place throughout this holiday season with proceeds directed toward local nonprofit Solid Ground, November 28th until December 31st. More information at wholefoodsmarket.com.
We have a mix of clouds and sunshine, 47 degrees right now in the U District. Forecast calls for clouds and scattered showers today, fairly breezy as well. Today's high in the upper 40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight, chance of evening rain, rain increasing overnight, the low in the upper 30s.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Jewish Community School. For 20 years, committed to challenging the minds and inspiring the hearts of students kindergarten through fifth grade. A school day tour for prospective parents will be held December 11th at 9 a.m. More at sjcs.net.
Now we delve into some tech with Todd Bishop, co-founder, national editor of GeekWire, the news technology source based here in Seattle. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Steve.
Excited about the holidays?
I am, yeah.
Are you assembling various ways that you can amass your giving and sharing your gifts?
I am. Actually, I've got my Christmas cards or my holiday cards and Christmas cards already out, actually. There's this great app called Ink, I-N-K. You can send your Christmas cards from your phone. So,
and these are like pictures that you've taken, or
yeah,
it can be anything?
Yeah, it's from the people who make Postagram, and they have a Christmas card version of it. So I sent out 27 cards for $50.
I love Postagram. Yeah. I used it when I was traveling.
Yeah,
it's a great thing.
It's Sincerely Ink, I-N-K. It's a great app.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Now, what else? What's Amazon? Amazon is like taking over the world?
Almost. Just overnight, they announced something really interesting. It's a new subscription service for their Kindle Fire tablets that lets parents basically pay a monthly fee to have user profiles for their kids and then get access to a ton of content for kids from everybody from Sesame Street to Sandra Boynton. You know, the Boynton books are really popular. And it's basically all you can eat, unlimited content for kids. For if you're a Prime subscriber, which means you're already paying $80 a year, it's $3 a month per kid. And then the rates go up from there depending on if you want a family plan or if you're not a Prime subscriber. So you know, $3 per month.
$120-something total.
So you're paying quite a bit, and it really gets to Jeff Bezos' philosophy of Amazon wants to charge you and have you pay when you use the device versus when you buy the device. So, yeah.
So I did not know that when a Kindle is started, a Kindle Fire, or is it all of them, you see ads?
You do see some ads, particularly on the lock screen, and it's with the Kindle devices as well, the e-readers. You can opt out on the Kindle Fire by paying a little bit more, but the default is to have ads on the lock screen. It's pretty unobtrusive.
Do they make money on those ads?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely they do, and that's a big part of Amazon's business plan is to subsidize the cost of the device with the cost of or the price of charging you for your content and then also serving up ads inside the tablet.
They have a pretty good business model.
Well, it's not it's pretty thin margins. You know, the profits that they make are very slim at this
point. That's why they have to have so much.
That's right. And so they're betting on a high volume, you know, low margin business. It's the traditional retail business that Amazon is still pursuing.
And so they're delivering restaurant meals?
Yes. So this is a new addition to the Amazon Fresh delivery service here in the Seattle region. It's actually great to live here and to, you know, be interested in technology. You know, Amazon Fresh, they rolled it out some number of years ago, and it is still just here. They are still trying to refine the offering. It has not expanded beyond Seattle.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's something that we get to see here in our backyard. And the thing that they announced this past week is that they're going to be delivering restaurant meals. So, for example, you can get a steak from Daniel's Broiler just ready to pop in your oven, or I guess if you're doing it correctly, you'd put it on a grill on the stove. But yeah, Amazon is getting into not quite hot meals, but fresh meals from restaurants.
Well, not hot though.
No, they actually get delivered. So say you order the bisque from Daniel's, you get it and you actually end up heating it up.
I see.
Yeah.
Because there were a couple of companies that were, what was one called? Restaurants on the Run.
Right.
And one other one. And they were, I guess they're still in business. They're doing restaurant deliveries. They sign up with particular restaurants, the hot meals, though.
Oh, right. Well, and this is with restaurants, but we've been meaning to test it. We're going to have to test it in the GeekWire offices. So I'm not sure if some of them are actually hot, but I don't think they are.
Do you guys have a kitchen?
We have a kitchen way in the back.
The GeekWire test kitchen?
With not quite that, but the company that we share space with has a kitchen, and they let us use it.
All right. So Windows 8.
Yes.
How's it doing?
So far, not so great. Overall, if you look at the sales of consumer PCs in the U.S., they're down just about 22% over the first month after Windows 8's release compared to the same period last year when it was just Windows 7 on the market. The one bright spot that we've seen so far are touchscreen notebooks. So in other words, the kinds of notebooks that you get where you can actually tap the screen, but they still look like a regular old laptop computer.
What are those brands?
You know, there's I think there's a really nice Acer one that has it. You know, Lenovo is another good one. They have something called a Yoga, which basically does a backflip to transform from a traditional notebook into a tablet. So there's most of the standard PC makers have these kinds of touchscreen notebooks, although Microsoft needs some more support in this area. But the nice thing is for Microsoft, they can charge more for these notebooks. So the notebook computer makers can charge, you know, upwards of $800-$900 or $1,000. And so that's lifting it out of this sort of low cost, low budget Windows PC.
Well, you wrote this article, touchscreen notebooks. My 2-year-old makes the case for Microsoft's Windows 8.
My daughter has, you know, sort of to my chagrin, started really picking up my phone and she's become a master of it. She can unlock the screen and go straight to her favorite app. And so she then walks up to my MacBook Pro, which of course is not touch enabled, and constantly is pressing the screen, expecting things to happen. And to me, this is, you know, I'm sure many people out there also have seen the same things with their kids. And it's evidence of the fact that this is where things are going. The generations that are just getting used to technology today, learning on these touchscreens, it's going to be almost just completely ridiculous to them to have a screen that's not touch enabled. And so the divide that you see here in the industry is that Apple doesn't believe, or at least they profess not to believe, that notebook computers should have touch screens. So far, at least, no Macs with touch screens. And Microsoft, in that way, is out ahead. And I think that they're out ahead in the right way. The question is whether they can continue to improve upon the technology, you know, change the keyboard layout, maybe make the screen on the notebook a little bit closer, or you know, adjust the trackpad somehow to make sure that these are actually effective implementations of touchscreens on notebooks. By the time that Apple inevitably concedes that, hey, this is obviously where things are headed.
I don't know. I look at this computer in front of me, and I'm always wanting to touch the screen now.
It is. And, you know, I don't think it's a replacement for the keyboard and mouse. It's certainly not a replacement for the keyboard. And I don't think it's a replacement for the mouse. I think it's more of a complement where you'll just come into situations where just naturally it'll be the right thing to do to reach out and swipe on the screen.
Well, it's like when you editing programs that we have to use here, right? There are shortcuts that you can use on the keyboard. There's shortcuts you use with the mouse. There's all sorts of different ways different learners master technology.
Right, and it just gives you another option. You know, Apple's contention is that, it looks great for a demo, but if you're sitting there on your desk and you have your arm out straight for hours on end, it's not going to work. I don't buy that. I think that used in conjunction with the keyboard and mouse, it's actually very nice to have.
So what does this lead us into what's happening with Surface then? How's Microsoft Surface doing?
Microsoft Surface, not so great so far, but the key there is that Microsoft is only selling it in its retail stores and on its online store. So the market is somewhat limited to begin with. Now, the device that's come out so far is Surface RT. It runs only on these low-powered ARM processors, the kinds of processors you would get in a normal tablet. Microsoft's going to be coming out in January with Surface for Windows 8 Pro, which is another ode to their branding there. But at any rate, that's a full-fledged Windows 8 PC. The problem is it's starting at upwards of, you know, $900, $1,000, which is quite a bit of money for a tablet, even if it does run traditional Windows 8 apps, which it does.
Their thinking is that because it's running those traditional programs, Word and Excel and all those things, that people might find it useful.
That's right. They're comparing it to the average Ultrabook PC, Ultrabook notebook, where you are able to take it around and use it like a computer.
How much do those cost?
The Ultrabooks, you know, they range in price from, you know, $700 to $1,100. They're in that range. Everything's fluctuating quite a bit, but you can get them for not a whole lot of money, especially for a Black Friday sale back a couple weeks ago. So it's a tough sell, especially because the Surface keyboards, which are the touch cover and the type cover, are not the same as a real notebook computer.
You've been using them.
I've been using them. And it's you can use them to, you know, type out and tap out messages, but it's not the same as having a real notebook. I mean, I use my regular notebook computer every single day, constantly for work. I cannot do that with the Surface keyboard. Now, you can plug in a regular keyboard to it, but that's not the proposition.
Yeah, now you're carrying around a keyboard.
Exactly. And the battery life, too, on the Surface Pro is expected to be somewhere in the range of 4 to 5 hours, which is just subpar compared to especially an Ultrabook PC. So bottom line, very tough sell for Microsoft here for the Surface going forward.
All right. So you have a MacBook Pro?
It's a MacBook Pro, yeah.
And, you know, this is what, 2 years old?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's very good. Good eye.
Yeah. it's not light, but it's not super heavy. It's
no.
A 13-inch one?
Or? Yeah, it's a 13-inch MacBook Pro.
So
yeah.
After experimenting with all the different Surfaces and tablets, you're back at that for your workhorse.
Here's the thing. I have my workflow so centered around, you know, specific devices and specific programs and techniques that I use. There's actually a little bit of inertia where it's for me to shift to a completely different computer for my day-to-day work. It would require about 3 or 4 weeks of adjustment, and I just haven't yet gone over that learning curve. I do like some of the Windows 8 notebooks that are out there, and frankly, I've been thinking lately, I mean, I don't want to confess this, but I think I've been thinking lately that the HTC 8X Windows Phone is looking very nice. And I've been tempted.
What do you have now?
I have an iPhone 4.
Wow.
Yeah.
Whew.
I know. Nah, it's
the world is shaking.
It is. And the nice thing is it works very well in conjunction with the Surface. See, so it's sort of like you have devices and computers that work very well in conjunction with one another for all the professing that these companies do about interoperability.
All right. There you hear Todd Bishop in getting ready, you know, for holiday time.
That's right.
Looking at all the different devices, some thoughts about thereof. Todd Bishop is co-founder, national editor of GeekWire, independent technology news site based in Seattle. He's also on the radio on the weekends on Cairo. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, let me do one last thing here before we end this fine program. We have been talking to folks throughout this week and right up into the holidays about what they're doing in terms of helping around the holiday season. So you can know about different places. Maybe you have some groups that you want to highlight. Go to our weekday page, weekday on KUOW, and post their groups you like. The Seattle Milk Fund assists and empowers struggling parents in who are pursuing a college education. Heather Fritz is development director of the Seattle Milk Fund. And this holiday season, they host the annual Cookie Fest at Macy's December 8th to raise money to assist low-income families who are pursuing college educations. Heather Fritz, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Steve.
Who are you assisting? Who are the people that are getting this help going to college?
We are assisting families, single parents and married parents who have kids who the parents are pursuing a college education within a public accredited institution within King County. It's often the parents that are struggling financially and are having a hard time getting childcare to allow them to go back to school.
How many people are you serving?
Well, in the last few years, we have served over 500 parents and more than 860 youth. Our families often have more than one child. And so we're reaching, you know, more than 1,000 individuals.
Wow.
that are trying to get a step up and improve their lives.
How long has Seattle Milk Fund been in existence?
1905. We have been in existence for more than 100 years. We were a volunteer-run organization for more than a century, which is just phenomenal when you look at the amount of nonprofits that come in and phase out in a year. We have been around for more than a century and are going strong with members, donors, and volunteers.
Now you have an annual spring luncheon at the Seattle Yacht Club. That's May 18th. You have a annual fall dinner auction, which is a fundraiser and a friendraiser, as you put it. What happens at Cookie Fest at Macy's on December 8th?
Oh, Cookie Fest is splendid. Cookie Fest is this fabulous holiday event that we have partnered with Macy's for since 1993. And it is where families and individuals line up at the door before Macy's even opens their doors. They have boxes in hand often or Tupperware containers that they walk in the door with. We provide boxes, but many are so passionate about this event, they come in droves. And when the doors open, people shoot through the doors to more than 20 bakeries that have booths lined up in like a U-shape holiday village. And they are in pursuit of their favorite cookie. They buy them by the dozens. They bring their children with them who sit and watch the Lincoln and Bass movies and do crafts with our volunteers. And then they are in and out of those doors within minutes of the cookies that they want in their boxes to eat or to freeze for later in the year or to share with friends. It's a phenomenal event.
That's December 8th, 9 to 1 at Macy's on the third floor. Many, many Seattle's best bakeries are going to be selling their cookies. Proceeds all going to the Seattle Milk Fund, help low-income families finding jobs, get control of their finances, help them help people go to college. Heather Fritz is Development Director of Seattle Milk Fund. Heather, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
And you will find links to their work at our website, KUOW.org, and also at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. Here's the sound of the day. That's the bird market in Paris. What is typically just an outdoor flower market, on Sundays it's transformed into a one-stop shop for birds of all shapes and sizes, finches, canaries, roosters, parrots, pigeons. Weekday listener Christine visited there in late November and recorded this sound. Rabbits and ferrets also make guest star appearances as people barter and haggle for birds, feed, housing, other avian equipment. What sounds are you hearing? Mail them to us via the email weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Kirkland Performance Center, presenting bassist, songwriter, and neo-soul performer Michelle Ndegeocello, performing songs from her latest album, A Dedication to Nina Simone, in concert at Kirkland Performance Center on Thursday, December 13th. More at kpcenter.org.
Next time on The Takeaway, collect them, trade them. How many of the seven deadly sins can you name? Have you committed? We won't tell, but if you'd like to share your tales of personal wrath, greed, sloth, pride, lust, envy, or gluttony, you know how to reach us. Join us for a conversation with Alex Clark, editor of The Seven Deadly Sins. Get in the holiday spirit next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.